Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned goods stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
That's what I should do. Okay. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I've been introducing this person as my sidekick, but basically she has been my right arm. She worked for me for 20 years. She's been a huge asset, not just to me in my profession, but also my family as well. I'm going to introduce Mallory to you right now. Say hey, Mallory, to everybody.
Hi, how's it going?
So Mallory now is my kind of business partner here, helping me behind the scenes and getting this podcast out to you all, and also a huge part of that. And she's the one who's been getting all these amazing guests on.
Yeah.
And I can't thank her enough for that. Mallory, 20 years.
20 years.
20 years.
Holy cow. I can't
Holy
believe it.
Moly. Where do we start? What brought you into my practice?
I was at the time, it was professional veterinary assistant school. I was working at a very seedy clinic, and I quit. And I needed to be working in order to stay in school, and PVAS sent me your way. So I actually got hired in kennel because you weren't hiring assistants at the time, even though I'd had previous experience. And I think I was in kennel about 2 weeks before I got kicked out of kennel because I was never in kennel. I was constantly forcing myself to be in the back. I wanted to be in the back. I wanted to be a tech. And finally, Carmelo came up to me and said, there's no point to keep you in kennel because you're never in kennel. You're always in treatment. So just go be in treatment. So I kind of self-promoted myself pretty quickly there.
What's kept you in the profession so long?
I love medicine and I love animals. And I think it's a great, great combination of both. I've always loved medicine and I've always loved animals. When I was in college, I was originally in school to be an EMT, and then I realized I really don't like people, so maybe I should kind of switch gears here and get into vet med. Where you deal with people even more.
Exactly.
You deal with people even more.
I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the ironic thing about the profession, right? We always, as a joke, people always say, hey, why aren't you a real doctor?
Right,
the RD, the real doctor.
Right.
And you usually say, well, I can't stand people.
I hate people.
But guess what? This job is what, 90% of the time dealing with people?
Client communication, yeah.
And it really makes you realize that there are amazing people out there.
Absolutely.
And there's 2% of the people out there that just make you hate your job.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never gotten past that fact. And the problem is, as humans, we just sit there and we just ruminate on that 2%. We forget about the 98%.
Right.
And that really can send you down a rabbit hole.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a few bad comments. We had really great clients. We were lucky. We had really great clients at our practice. You know, sometimes a little entitled, sometimes, most of the time, very opinionated. And sometimes those opinions just hit you the wrong way. Sometimes you're having a bad day, you have your own stuff going on, and they just happen to say those few right words that really just make you kind of question everything you're doing and wonder why you're staying in the field. And if you are as good as you think you are, as good as, you know, your practice is.
And what a lot of people don't understand is you got to control your emotions.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there was a couple of times that you were ready to go out and go to blows.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you pretty early on, you deemed me your HR nightmare. So because of that, I guess had less client interaction maybe than the rest of our techs did. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're defending yourself. You're defending the care. You're defending the practice. What they don't see is, I love the comment of, you know, when we would call and say, hey, you know, maybe we need to run some extra labs, take some x-rays. People's comment is, oh, well, wouldn't you like the money? Or I'm sure that's great for your pocketbook. It didn't matter to me. I wasn't on the receiving end of that, right, when I was first starting. So just comments like that really get to you. Like, we're not in it for the money. We are in it for the patient care. And I think when you start to question my morality and the morality of the practice and the morality of my co-workers, I was ready to throw down a few times.
Yeah, you were. But you're also able to manage the situations.
Yeah.
You could, you know, defuse that bomb pretty easily.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always loved about you, is because you have so many opinions, so few filters, just like I do.
Yeah.
And you learn the art of controlling your emotions.
Yeah.
What is the biggest problem you see with these early career veterinarians that are coming out?
As far as early career vets, I think we're even seeing it with technicians and assistants too, is that they are so offended by everything, and they tend to seem like they just really are internalizing everything. They're taking everything to heart, every comment, and now with social media being such a big part of it, you know, you go on social media pages, nobody ever really writes good Yelp reviews. We've talked about this before, right? So I think, like you said, they're really just ruminating on these few experiences, and it's burning them out quicker than they need to be burning out.
Yeah. The more you ruminate about it, the more you're going to get exhausted.
Yeah.
Emotionally. The more you're going to have a lack of self-worth.
Absolutely. And then you start to kind of question what you're doing. Like, you've given 10 million IV injections, and now you're like, can I hit a vein? Do I know what I'm doing? And I think it affects your skill level, your tech work, and even what you know in your head or what you've been taught, trained, learned, kind of can all go out the window when you get really down on yourself.
Because everyone has a bad vein day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or a bad vein week. Yeah. I mean, there are times that you're seeing that vein look at you like...
It's like a fire hose.
Like this pen,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you cannot get anywhere near it.
Right. And then you have days where you place a 22-gauge catheter and an 18-year-old kidney cat, and you're like... I'm back. Let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go. It's my vein day.
Yeah. What is the one thing you wish that most veterinarians would do with their technicians as far as a relationship?
I think you and I have worked very closely, like you said, for a really long time. And we've probably spent thousands of hours in surgery together. There's doctors I love to go into surgery with. And then there's doctors where, you know, we were secretly like playing rock, paper, scissors to see who would be stuck in surgery with them. But I think really just being there for your technicians, right? Like, as these vets want to be mentored, they need to realize that the people below them, or not below them, but their coworkers, technicians, whatever, receptions, they need support too, right? Like, you're only as strong as your weakest link. So I think what's really important for these vets to realize is that they affect the whole hospital. You are the vibe of your tribe, you know? Help them out. Let them know that you're there for them. You trained us to look at lab work before we even bothered you. Like, if I came in and said, hey, labs are done, you used to look at us and say, what's wrong? But it was for us to learn, right? And for us to know what we were dealing with. And we weren't obviously the ones
calling. Let's make it very clear. I always did look at the lab work.
Yeah, no, you did. Yes, you did. You did always look at the lab work. But you expected us to come to you with some type of answer. And I loved that. I loved that type of training. I mean, there were times we would take x-rays and we had our walkie-talkies on our watches and we would just be like, you got to get in here. But I think that led you to trust us more because you knew when we said, oh, shit, it meant something.
Yeah, I think it's very important to have that strong trust,
yeah.
Friendship. I'm not saying socially, but
right.
Professionally, for sure.
Right.
I mean, if you do get into a little bit of the social aspect, that's huge as well.
Yeah.
Because then you really understand where a person's coming from. If they're having a bad day, you really know that, hey, they really are having a bad day. Probably doesn't have to do with work.
Yeah.
It has something probably on the outside. Do you need to talk about it? Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people would say, oh, no, no, you shouldn't do that. But, you know, a veterinary practice, you spend more time with your staff than you do with your family.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
And they become your family.
Yeah.
And, again, that's a human thing.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with a lot of veterinarians out there that just really don't get to know who they're working with.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was something that we definitely emphasized at our practice. I have two examples for you. At one point, I'm adopted, and I was going through some stuff with my biological family. And I went on my lunch break, had a major meltdown, came back, and I believe you handed me Medrol. It was something white in a syringe. And you said, hey, go give this to Fluffy. And I said, do you want me to give it IV? And you grabbed the syringe out of my hand and said, go outside and get your shit together and come back in when you know the answer. And not everybody likes, you know, to be talked to. I love it, right? I thrive because in that moment I was like, you're right. I need to clear my head. I need to get back into my workspace. I need to get my head back in the game, and I can deal with my problems later. Another one was when we were going through, I guess you went through it with me. I was going through IVF, and you walked in the morning. I had gone in, I think it was 7 o'clock. I think by the time you came in, it was like 7:38, and no hospitalized had been done, and I was just staring at the treatment board, and you were like, what's wrong? And I was like, I don't understand this. And you were like, oh, the hormones. Here
the
we
hormones,
go. Okay,
yeah.
You're like, where the hormone is.
The
all right.
Hormones.
And I teched rooms for the rest of the day because you knew that I had started a new round of IVF. I had increased hormones. My brain was absolute mush. You knew
pregnancy
that.
Pregnancy brain.
Right, yeah. And you knew that, yep, if I was still standing there half an hour later and hospitalized weren't done, like, clearly something's wrong here, right? But had you not known what we were going through personally or what I had going on in my life, you know, you might have just been like, oh my God, here. What the hell is she doing, right? Like, yeah. What is going on here?
And that's part of the problem I have with, it's not a problem. I don't want to say that negatively, but I think these relief veterinarians, they are missing out.
Yeah.
They are
yeah.
missing out on those types of relationships. I understand relief veterinarians are great because it truly becomes more of a 9-to-5. Once you leave, you're done. You don't have to deal with it. You don't have to, like, follow up with the clients. You don't
yeah.
have to do anything.
You don't like a clinic. You don't have to go back. You're not there every day, right?
I mean, it's like having a traveling nurse, but traveling nurses sign up for 6 weeks at a time.
Right.
You know, and exactly. Yeah, you know immediately whether or not you want to go back to that practice. The culture could be toxic. The clients could be not what your cup of tea.
Right.
So, yeah, there are definitely positives. What do you see as the biggest change in the last 20 years in the profession?
I really think it comes down to, and this isn't to say that all corporations are bad. I mean, I do think you need a healthy amount of each, right, to have corporate and private owned. But I really think the big shift that I've seen is everything going from private practice to corporate. The clinic that we were so fortunate to be a part of had two owners for over 60 years. So that was something that our clients expected, was consistency. They wanted to see the same people when they walked in. They wanted to have the same person answering the phone. They wanted to guarantee that that quality of care was still there. They knew their pets were going to be taken care of when, you know, we were there. Clients had your cell phone number. Clients had the previous owner's home number that he could call, and he would meet them down there in the middle of the night. How many nights you guys spent at the hospital, or how many times we went checked and hospitalized at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. I just don't feel that level of dedication is quite there anymore. I don't think anybody wants to be spending the night in the hospital dealing with hospitalized cases. You fight so hard for your practice when it's your practice and when you have some skin in the game. I don't think these relief veterinarians, and not to say that relief is bad, we definitely needed it once you had retired, but you gotta have some skin in the game, I think, for them to really be fully, wholeheartedly invested. And I really hope the pendulum swings back the other way because, I mean, practice ownership is amazing once you can get in there, you know?
Practice ownership was one of the most rewarding things I've done.
Yeah.
Also the most let me put my head through a wall things I've done.
Right. You also, I do have to say, though, have a tendency to pick very type A, loud, obnoxious women to work around you. So I don't know if that played into any of your...
What did I used to call them? Alpha dominant bitches.
Yeah, we were. I mean, but if you...
And I love my profession because I could say bitch. We're allowed right? to say bitch because that's a female dog.
And we can't get offended.
Yeah. But you know, the thing is that alpha dominant women, I mean, my wife is very strong like that. My
yeah.
kids are very strong like that.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law, my mom was like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I do have a type.
You know? So that might have been part of the reason for wanting to put your head through the wall. Maybe not.
Well, putting my head through the wall was also because, I mean, there's so many things that come into running a practice successfully. Relationships are number one.
Yeah.
Putting your trust and depending on people.
Yeah.
to be there when they say they're going to be there, to do, get their job done when they say they're going to get their job done, to not lie to you, to, you know, really have your back.
Right.
When you're not there.
Right.
You know, at first, it took forever. And, you know, Sarah, our practice manager, did an amazing job creating that type of staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, and then I took it under my wing then to train them.
Right.
And then once I knew I had very, very strong employees, I allowed the employees to start training the new employees because they knew the standard we were looking for.
Right. But with that also being done, we had a very, very low turnover rate. I mean, we weren't, and I think that's also, you know, speaks to the volume, but also speaks to the environment of the hospital, right? I mean, I think when, you know, a few years ago before kind of the downfall, as you call it, our newest employee, I think, was 4 years in. But we ranged from 4 years to 32 years. So it's I think that's really hard to find.
It is. And again, I was trying also to be like a not a doctor mentor, but also a life mentor to a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I did. There was a couple of our employees that thought they never could get through college.
Right.
And all of a sudden, boom, what do you know? They have a master's.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all believing in them. So right. What do you look for a good doctor-technician relationship?
I think straight up from the get-go, you have to be honest. You know, you have to, whether you're having a good day, whether you're having a bad day, whether you think you fucked up giving medication, whether you think you dosed something wrong, whether you, oh, shit, I didn't scrub in, but now they're starting to cut. It, just anything. But just you have to be honest and transparent, I think, through the whole, your whole entire relationship. Also, someone that's willing to teach. You loved to teach. I wish I had pictures of all your crappy drawings on the whiteboards because you loved to grab a marker and be like, well, if this works like this, and then this goes here, and you would talk us through everything. So I think them willing to educate, having trust in them, and wanting to grow a relationship together. I mean, I think that's something that's really important. We had, towards the end, we had three doctors at our practice, and I had a great relationship with all three of them, and my relationship with each of you was different. You know, I have a different relationship with you versus your associates. So I think really just trying to grow as a team is really important too.
Well, selfishly, another reason why I wanted to train you guys is so you could go into the rooms and have a conversation with clients that actually would make sense.
Yes.
If I was, and I told everyone, and I everyone listening, you're only as strong as your team.
Yeah.
You're successful because your team is successful.
Yeah.
You can't look at this as an individual thing, right?
Right.
You need to count on everyone to know what they're doing and how they're doing it. Yes, you should have a job description, but at Canyon, we never had job descriptions because everyone knew what was required of them.
Right.
From the people that were there.
Yeah.
It was never in question.
It was a well-oiled machine.
Obviously, kissing Dr. G's ass was not on that.
No, we weren't that nice to you.
You guys kept me humble.
Yeah, for sure.
And I loved you all for that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I checked the ego at the door, you know, and everyone will always say, oh, Dr. G has such an ego, and it would be my technicians that are like, he doesn't have an ego. He's just very confident in his abilities.
Right.
But you probably still think I have an ego, but that's fine.
You know, it's okay. It's okay. My opinion doesn't matter here, right?
Oh my gosh, here we go. So can you, without naming any names, unless you really want to.
All right, let's see.
Have you had any bad relationships with doctors?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, one specifically.
What made that relationship bad?
Attitude. I think we just didn't see eye to eye. I guess I shouldn't judge. I wasn't a huge fan of the way they practiced. They were socially a little awkward. And they were just straight up rude. And I don't think you need to be rude to your staff. And it really just made me not want to help them. They would ask for x-rays. And it's, you know, I'm sure I didn't help. I would give an eye roll and be like, all right, I'll go do x-rays. So I'm sure I wasn't the most approachable person in that
not
situation.
Not me.
If I don't say it, my face usually does, right? So as much as I try to keep my mouth shut, sometimes the eye rolls just happen. But, yeah, just they were almost entitled to be there, better than everyone. And just rude. And I, like you said, you're only as strong as your weakest link, right? You're only as strong as your weakest member. So.
Well, and you got, it took my staff to bring it all to my attention about the issues. And you were like, everyone, when I say you, yeah. everyone on the staff was like, she might be or he might be a great veterinarian.
Right.
But they're horrible for the team.
Yeah.
They're horrible for the culture.
Yeah.
And I had to make that awful decision to let them go.
Yeah.
I knew it would bring more work my way, but yeah. I didn't want to upset my team.
Yeah. And I think, too, you always had our back. There was one time I remember a client made, like, very derogatory comments to two or three of us, and we never saw that client again, right? So I think just really having everybody having each other's back, right? Or, like, I think I was the one that would always get, hey, this guy just yelled at me because of X, Y, and Z, and I'd be like... I have your back. Like, I'll go outside and talk to him. You don't need to go back out there and deal with that again, right?
If a client treats your staff horribly, that is a red flag.
Yeah. Well, it's just going to go down. It's a trickle effect.
No, but it's a red flag, too. Like,
yeah.
What are they saying about you behind your back?
Right.
You know, and the biggest thing with a client-patient relationship is trust.
Yeah.
And if they're talking smack to the staff that's taking care of the animals.
Yeah.
Then, unfortunately, that just means they probably don't trust me because right. I'm in charge of hiring all of you and having you all around.
And I think what people don't realize, and I think this has kind of been a shift too, you know, I think, not with how hard people are willing to work, but I think kind of like work ethic has changed a little bit. I feel like what people fail to realize is there were mornings, you know, I would get there at 7 a.m. and we weren't leaving till 10 o'clock at night. And we were back the next morning at 7 a.m. So our life revolved around our work schedule. A lot of those times for those 14-hour days, we didn't have lunch. We didn't have breaks. And you just do it. But you do it because the patients need help. The patients need care. We were there. That's what we were good at. That's what we thrived at doing. And we made it work. So when the clients are rude to you, you know, it's like, gosh, in the beginning, I'm not making great money. I'm working 14, 16 hours a day. I am in school on top of this. I have no social life. And, like, you're yelling at me over $10 on your bill or $15 on your bill. It's really not great. It doesn't make you feel great. You know, it doesn't make you want to go out on the limb and spend another night at the hospital for them. It doesn't make you want to go in at 4 a.m. to check on hospitalized.
What advice would you give veterinarians, especially the ones that are just starting their career, to be better delegators?
Absolutely. If you know that you're in a clinic that has a strong staff and you are gaining confidence in your staff, there is no shame in passing it on. You had your office and we just yelled at you all day. Hey, this is what's going on. You would go through the record, yell back, and we just took care of it. I knew your doses. I would say for 95% of the animals and cases that you saw, and you and I had talked about it. And anytime you would say, hey, give this dog meloxicam, I knew your dose. If the dose changed, then you would tell me, hey, it's a cat. We're going to go down to 0.1 instead of 0.2 mg per kg or whatever it was. And we just rolled with it. But you knew that we knew our doses. You told us exactly what you wanted. And we knew what routes to give medication unless, you know.
So when a veterinarian goes on an interview to a clinic, do you think they should look at the relationship that the veterinarians have with the technicians there while they're there?
Yeah, I think that's a really important way to kind of see the whole dynamic of the clinic. If you have technicians and receptionists who are scared to ask doctors questions or scared to approach the doctors, then maybe that might not be the right clinic for you. That might not be where you want to be. We were very open at our clinic, and I have some friends who are at other clinics, and they're like, God, you could hear a pin drop here because you have to wait till this is done. Everything is done in a very specific order. Everything is very streamlined, which is great. But, you know, client questions aren't being answered. Medications aren't getting refilled. The hospitalized animals in the back aren't quite getting enough care because they're waiting for that moment where they can approach the doctor or they can approach someone to ask questions to. And I think that's tough.
So you think another very important value or thing to have, soft skill to have, would be approachability?
Absolutely. I could tell from a mile, and maybe it's just our, but I could tell from a mile away whether I was should go into your office and bug you about med refills, or if I was like, oh shit, I just need to save this for the hospitalized animal in the back, or for the, you know, hey, surgery's starting, we're getting into surgery, you're ready to go, whatever it was. But I think you have to be approachable, and you did a really good job of showing up and being there for everybody. I mean, you we should put up pictures of this, but I mean, you were sleeping in the back because you were dying with your pancreas stuff going on. And
my appendix.
Oh, your appendix. That's right. Not your pancreas.
I worked the whole day with appendicitis.
Yeah. And we just sat there taking pictures and making fun of you. And you finally went home. And like 2 hours later, you're like, oh, I'm getting my appendix removed. And we were like, oh, shit. Like maybe we should have been a little nicer. But even when you were sick and dying, I mean, we were still yelling stuff out the window and throwing stuff at you. But you allowed us to do that, right? You allowed us to be able to approach you even if it wasn't the right moment.
You now work at the veterinary, what is it? It's the Orange County
Veterinary Assistance School.
Assistance School, right?
Yeah.
OCVAS.
Yes.
Are you seeing signs of burnout in technicians?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing. We have essentially like a 45-week program for you to get licensed. It takes about over a year with everything. But we have students who aren't even making it through the program and they're already burnt out. And I don't know that veterinary medicine is for everybody. If it chooses you and sucks you in, it is a great profession that I absolutely love and I can't imagine doing anything else or have, you know, been doing anything else. But, you know, you're mentally tired, you're physically tired, you're emotionally tired. It takes everything out of you. And I think a lot of people get into it because they're like, oh my God, dogs are fluffy. And I love puppies. And what you realize is you don't see puppies, right? I mean, a very minimal amount of your practices. I mean, you give them vaccines, you spay and neuter them, you see them once a year for the next, you know, 7-8 years. And then once they start to have problems is when you start to get involved. And I don't think people realize the bonds that they build even with like our patients, right? Like watching these patients get sick, watching them get better. Sometimes, you know, when you end up euthanizing, now you have relationships with the family and now you're grieving essentially with the family, right? And I mean, we had one client who was like very pregnant, remember? And we were like, oh my gosh, she's gonna go into labor while we're euthanizing her dog. Like this is, it just, I mean, every day is different. Every day is a roller coaster. So if you like regimented 9 to 5, this is what I'm doing. Like, it's not for you.
If I was to say to you, my biggest value in life is work-life balance.
Yeah.
Is clinical veterinary medicine possibly the field for me?
No, absolutely not. No, I think it's getting better. I think there's been a big shift. And I'm jealous of that. Right? I'm jealous that now everybody is like, wow, there's work-life balance and this is what I'm doing for my mental health. And I'm like, well, shit.
Honestly, would you change anything about your career right now?
No. I absolutely loved it. I feel lucky that I was involved in veterinary medicine when I was. Once you left the clinic we were at, we were running strictly off relief vets. And that really, Morgan said something not too long ago, you know, the grass isn't always green, it's gold. And you know, I'm Italian, so not only do I talk with my hands, but like you said, I get kind of fired up sometimes. And there were multiple times where you and I had kind of gotten into it, and I was like, I'm going to leave, I'm out of here, this and that. And really, ultimately, like, you're never going to find another practice like that again, right? And even, like...
You tried.
Yeah, I tried, right? I went up to the zoo for a little bit, I did mobile work for a little bit, and then I, like, came crawling back because I was like, oh my gosh, I can't. Like, I thought we had issues? Oh my gosh, look what else is going on everywhere else, right? I don't even remember where I was going with that, but...
So, how can veterinarians, what should they do to keep the good team? What else can be done? What can veterinarians do to make sure their team that they love and support stays strong and healthy?
I mean, I think at this point, you really just have to listen to your staff. When we started to get burnt out... we had gone from like 10, 12-hour shifts, and then we all got cut to 8-hour shifts, which I feel like helped a little bit. Everybody was working full-time, but you could kind of see the hours start dwindling a little bit. We had a few more technicians on staff. I think just being staffed well is a huge, huge help in veterinary medicine. You don't always know, right? You can have a slow day, you can have a busy day, so it's kind of hard to gauge sometimes. But being adequately staffed, like my love language is food, right? We had Fat Girl Fridays. Every Friday, everybody brought something in and we ate offensive amounts of food like all day long. knowing your
value. The Canyon 25, we used to call it.
Yeah, it's like worse than the College 15. It's the Canyon 25. I mean, it gets you. It's a real thing.
It's
a real thing.
Hey, I'm not kidding you.
I mean, we were like McDonald's 9:30. Then we would bust into like 7-layer dip at 10:30. We had full barbecue Mexican feast delivered by noon. And then at 2 o'clock, the ice cream guy would drive by. And we were like, let's go get ice cream. I mean, but I think you just really have to, well, one, know your value as a technician. Make sure you're being valued the same way you value your practice. And just support. I think it really just comes down to support. If you feel like you have people you can lean on, it really makes all the difference.
Well, vet medicine is very emotionally heavy.
Yes.
It's very hard on the clients.
Yeah.
It's very hard on the staff. It's very hard on the veterinarians. I mean, there are a lot of difficult, crucial conversations that need to be had.
Yeah.
How did you used to decompress after a hard day?
The beginning of my career, I had a horse, so I would just go to the stables and ride, and that was kind of my outlet to just get away from everything. You have to find something you're passionate about. You have to find something else outside of veterinary medicine. I don't know if it's a mistake. Still some of my best friends to this day, but when I first started, we were all really, really good friends. Everybody who worked in the clinic together. So we were working all day together, going out at night together, and we really didn't have a balance between our friendship and our work life. Everything was kind of merged together. And I think that's great that you love your coworkers and you can rely on your coworkers, but I think when you have a lot of overlap, that can be really hard too, because then at that point, my whole life was veterinary medicine.
A few tequila cocktails, and then all of a sudden it carries into the clinic the next day.
Yes, yes, yeah. So I think that was kind of one of the lessons that I learned. Like, yes, you can be friends with everybody and you can have these great relationships with everybody, but you have to have things outside of veterinary medicine. Otherwise, you're out talking about cases. You're out talking about the day. And it's great to have people that can relate to you and that have seen whatever shit show happened during the day, but you have to be able to separate from the clinic at some point.
Even if it's going out with a different, completely different group of friends.
Right, right.
And realize that if these friends are not in veterinary medicine, they're not going to understand what you're going through.
Right. And they don't want to hear it. I mean, some friends do, but if we had dinner not too long ago with some of our friends who are all techs, and the husbands rolled their eyes at us. We were eating Italian food, and we started talking about maggots. Every single husband got up and walked away. And they're like, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? Like, nobody wants to talk about maggots while we're eating dinner. And Aaron's like, oh, you know, we're lucky we didn't bring up diarrhea. This is that. And the guys are like, oh, my God, get out of here. But not that people in vet med aren't normal, but most people in vet med really want, like, the cliff note version of your day, right? They don't want to know everything that's going on.
What's the funniest client interaction you remember?
Client interaction? We had a client who used to give us massages. And that just was awkward on so many levels, but I always thought that was fun. Funny client. I don't know. Do you have a good one?
Oh, I have a few, yeah.
But what's one of yours?
The one where I had a client that lifted up her shirt to show me how the puppy latches onto the nipple.
You had the one who sent you a picture in her bed with her boobs hanging out, and she was like, oh, look at the mass on my dog, and it was... There was no mass visible on the dog. It was just boobs.
She had two masses.
Yes, two masses that were attached to her.
Yeah, not the dog.
You had one pull her pants down a little bit, right?
To show me a rash.
Yeah, to show you a rash on her that Correct. She wanted you to diagnose.
Right, yeah. I still remember the one that still, I think, offended you because you still brought it up. We had a lady that told us that she defeated breast cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Because... she changed her diet.
Yeah, I think it was it like broccoli, right? It was something random.
She changed, she changed her diet. And,
yeah.
She didn't do chemo.
Right.
She just changed her diet.
Yeah, and I think we had one of our receptionists at that time was going through very aggressive breast cancer and just had a mastectomy.
Radical mastectomy,
yeah.
Yes.
And
I mean, they took out ribs and everything. Yeah. I mean, it was a very aggressive treatment. And
I was like, what? I can't believe this lady isn't talking about that.
It turned out both the masses that were moved.
Yeah. They were benign, right?
They were benign mammary tumors.
Yeah. Yeah.
like dense tissue or something.
Right. And she was like, oh, but it was my diet change that fixed everything. And we're like, oh, so you didn't have anything removed? Oh, no. Well, I had them removed and they were benign. We were like, huh.
I mean, yeah. I mean, there are stories that clients say things that.
Or I think my favorite one is when you go to take a temp. Right. And every client will be like, oh, I mean, the worst one was we had very awkward
clients.
I know
where you're going with this.
You know where I'm going. Right. And they would they'd love to tell you about their sex life. Right. As soon as you put a thermometer in the butt, someone always has a comment of, oh, no, we don't go there. Oh, mommy doesn't like it either. But I think the most awkward ones are when people are like, oh, yeah, get in there. We love that, don't we? And I'm like, oh, my God.
Honey, that's a preview of what we're going to do tonight.
Oh, that's right. That's what it was. Yeah, that's what we're going to do later. I was like, oh, my God, get me out of this room.
I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, we could go, we could do a three-hour episode of all the crazy things.
Right?
That things
and if there's any people listening who go to vet clinics, if you're wearing a dress, wear underwear because we are ground level. So make sure you cross your legs and are
wearing
underwear.
Or if you're wearing shorts, make sure they're not short shorts. And if there are short shorts on a guy.
Yeah, the huevos need to be tucked in.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Contained somehow.
Exactly. Contain the beast.
Yes.
The dragon.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the most bizarre case that you remember?
I think one of my favorite cases, I was thinking about this earlier, I think one of my favorite cases, just because the dog was such an asshole, was Bugsy. Came in for limping. The owner was like, oh, I think he's walking weird. We were like, all right. So we kind of watched him walk, and we were like, oh, I guess we'll take x-rays. We took x-rays, and we were thinking of a C-spine, being a Frenchie, and he ended up eating a Christmas ornament that had perfed through the intestines. So we were in there doing the foreign body, and just for fun, I don't know why, you were like, I'm going to check his spleen. Giant splenic mass. So then our foreign body turned into splenectomy, turned into, it was like a trifecta, wasn't it? He had the perf, and then maybe another foreign body, and then a
splenectomy.
Bladder
stones.
That's it. That's what it was, bladder stones. And I just remember thinking, God, this is the worst dog.
For limping.
Yeah, for limping. Like, how did this limping case now turn into, like, a trifecta?
But those are the fun cases. I mean, those are. That's why you get into medicine.
Like, I love scoping. I used to love when we would scope. We had a dog named Homer, remember, who ate the beer bottle cap?
And I got it.
You did. You did. I mean, it took us.
Were you there the time that the dog ate that flexible Frisbee?
Yes.
And I grabbed it and pulled it out?
We had, I think, one of my favorite ones. I mean, for me, hands down, my favorite surgeries are foreign bodies because I love seeing what comes out because half the time the owners don't know. And I love a big, fat splenectomy. I love those 20-pound masses that we used to pull out that
I think the record was, 26 pounds on the ridgeback, right?
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that ridgebacks usually get these benign.
Right.
Benign, large splenic masses.
Yeah.
Not saying they're all benign, but on a ridgeback, you got about a good chance that they are benign. I don't know what it is with the breed.
Yeah.
I never, ever had them come back aggressive.
Yeah.
And I remember, I know exactly who the client is.
Yeah.
He was the athletic director of one of the local high schools, and I was calling Coach. And I'm like, Coach, you know your dog's mass was 25 pounds?
Yeah.
Because he was like, oh, she's not eating well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nowhere for the food to go. There's no room in that
Your dog
abdomen.
Thinks she's pregnant with like 14 puppies with that much in there.
We had that other splenectomy where the dog came in for a bath. Remember?
Oh, I know exactly who that was, too.
Yeah. And then collapsed.
Collapsed. He came in for a bath.
Or her weekly bath. She came every week for a bath. Came in for a weekly bath and collapsed. And we ended up having to do a splenectomy.
And the crazy thing is that owner is rather famous.
Yeah.
And they were phenomenal. And
amazing.
It came, hemangiosarcoma that had ruptured.
Yep.
And the dog lived for 4.5 years on the metronomic protocol.
Yeah. Yeah. Post-op. Amazing.
It was amazing.
And she did great the whole entire time, too. But, yeah, I love splenectomies. I love foreign bodies. The other really good one that I have was when we had we removed female undergarments.
Oh, yes. That didn't belong to any of the females in the house?
There were no females in the house, remember?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a fun conversation too. You know what our dog ate? And we're like, well, we have the baggie for you.
And the best one is there any chance your dog could have gotten into marijuana?
Just say yes. Yeah. We're not gonna call the cops. Just say yes.
Well, it's legal now. But but even then, it's just like, it did. Yeah, it did.
And then you induce vomiting and the whole hospital smells like weed. You're like, are you kidding me? Or they're like, no, there's no way. And then you tell them all, we're going to treat him like weed talks, steering you X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And then it comes back and they're like, oh, well, you know, my teenage sons were home alone yesterday for 6 hours. And I thought the house smelled a little funny. Like, just say yes. It's a possibility.
Most frustrating moment that turned into a great learning experience. You already said the grass isn't greener.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's huge. If you're comfortable where you're at and you love that, I think really ultimately for me, it always came down to what type of medicine are we practicing, right? I never wanted to be ashamed of where I worked or ashamed of the medicine that I was practicing or going home at night thinking, why are we doing this? Why did we do that? But I really think, what is it? You kill more bees with honey than you do with... Or not kill more bees. Because you attract bees.
More bees with honey than you do with lemon juice, yeah.
And I think very early in my career, I was very just kind of like entitled and bratty and young. And I was a bitch. I remember people crying and I was like, we don't pay you to cry. Like, clock out and then come back, right? Or like, that's fine, go home.
We also had new employees on the first day that say, oh, it's my lunchtime, and they never came back.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't love to see, like, my personal Google reviews, right? Like, if I had my own Yelp, I'm sure some of my reviews wouldn't be that great in my early career. But I think ultimately what it comes down to is you just remember that people are people. Most people are trying their best, not everybody. Veterinary medicine isn't for everybody, and it's okay to give a gentle nudge maybe every once in a while to maybe kind of help them figure it out.
One skill that needs to make you stand out as a veterinarian.
Soft skills, communication and trust, hands down. If you're not communicative and you're not honest, clients, I think, pick up on that really quickly. They feel lied to, they feel misled, and they're going to make your job a lot harder.
Do you think that's one of the biggest mistakes young vets make? Is that they're afraid to admit?
Yeah, and I think there's something you always kind of used to tell everybody was like, stop chasing zebras. You know, they are... You may have cases that...
Not everything has Cushing's.
Right. And not everything's always going to be black and white, right? And
you're not always everything is diabetic.
Right, and you're not always going to have typical Cushing's. I mean, we used to see quite a few, you know, atypical Cushing cases. Atypical Addisonian cases. But you're going to make mistakes. It's practicing medicine. Nobody has it mastered. I mean, even after you being in it for 32 years, I'm sure there's still times you can pick out and say, God, I wish I did this different, or maybe I could have handled this case different. But, you know, learning as you go, always learn, right? Always continuing your education, always staying in the loop of what's going on and how the medicine is progressing. But just go in there and do your best. And if you're going in there and you're doing your best and you have a brave face on and, you know, like Morgan said, she's like, a lot of times I'm just practicing breathing techniques when I'm really like melting down inside. You know, don't let the client see that part for you. But we've cried with clients, right? We've celebrated with clients. We've cried with clients. So I think kind of humanizing yourself a little bit to them too, right? And as soon as they start to not trust you,
it's over.
It's over.
Yeah, it's over.
And it's hard too because you don't want to, I think something that, you know, is really hard to separate as well is you can have the best dog in the whole world who you absolutely love and that owner can come in and be such a POS. It almost makes you not like the dog. And it's really hard to separate your clients from your patients.
Well, immediately, I never looked at clients.
You can't.
I always cared about the animal.
Yeah, you can.
The animal was always the most important thing to all of us.
Yeah.
Even if the owner was a complete, it wasn't a difficult situation.
Right.
My ultimate goal, and I made sure my staff's ultimate goal was the well-being and benefit of that animal.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we used to joke, we'd like take him out and do, you know, flush catheters, do meds and stuff in the morning, and we'd be like, your owner's not very nice, but we love you. And we're like in the back baby talking everything, you know, but you have to learn to separate it, right? Like, mm-hmm. whether you like these owners or not, you know, again, the pets, right? That's what we're in it for. We're there for the animals. So,
I always look at pets and I don't try to, I'm not calling them infants, but they're like having an infant.
Oh, for sure.
They can't talk. They're not doing well.
Yeah.
And they're really, even if they're showing their teeth and growling at you,
yeah,
they're also depending on you to make them better.
Right. And I think that was something that I always loved. I don't know if everybody in VetMed loves this. I would hope they do. But I love figuring out the puzzle. I love that they can't talk. I mean, there's sometimes where you're like, you wish they could and just tell you what's going on. But I love using all the things that we had, all our toys, all our machines, to be able to figure out what is going on. And I mean, when you have animals that come in flat and you're like, oh my gosh, where do we even start? And then they're eating dinner the next night, walking out, you're like, oh my God, like this is amazing, you know? And without those people, without those people's trust, like we wouldn't be able to do that, you know?
Yeah, those cases that you have that come in that are just, I don't want to say on death's doorstep, but not doing well.
Yeah.
Not doing well. Those that walk out of that hospital.
It's the best feeling in the world.
The best feeling in the world.
It's amazing. And I love when, you know, they've been, I don't love when they're kind of depressed for us, you know, but they've been kind of depressed in the hospital. A lot of times we would kind of send home early, midday, let them see how they did at home, see if they could get them to eat, see if they could perk up. And we're like, oh, you know, things are getting better. Blood work looks better. There's really no more need for IV fluids. We just can't get them to eat. You know, we're doing all these appetite stimulants. And then they see that owner and like the light on the animal's faces when they see their human running down the hallway, wagging their tail. Oh my gosh.
And also promote sunshine therapy.
Yeah.
Have the owners come and take the dog outside if the dog can't walk, have your staff lift the dog outside so they can sit on a blanket or something.
Absolutely.
Because sunshine therapy is a therapy.
Yeah. And the dog, we try to make it as happy as we can, but at the end of the day, they're still in a cage in a back. There's a lot going on. There's other hospitalized patients. There's surgeries. There's tech checks, doctor checks, drop-offs. I mean, emergencies, all of it, right? So sometimes they just want to see your face and just sit outside in the sun and enjoy it for a little bit. And I mean, how many times were owners like, okay, I'll bring some chicken. And that was like the turnaround they needed was a little bit of sunshine and chicken.
And chicken.
And chicken.
Everything gets better with chicken.
Right?
Situation. How would you explain early career vets, especially to take care of this? Dog comes in, cat comes in, hamster, rabbit, I don't care. Okay. Not doing well. Okay. On emergency. They're in a panic. They're crying. Oh, let's say dog hit by car.
Yeah.
What's the most important thing that veterinarian can do?
I feel like I keep going back to communication. I mean, obviously, once you're done doing your doctoring, right, and you figure out what's going on and what needs to be done, going up and having a face-to-face, if the client's still there, a lot of times we would want to stabilize and then we would just have the owners kind of wait. But that open conversation and being empathetic, right? I mean, I'm so sorry. You know, I can't imagine what you just saw. You saw your dog get hit by a car. We had a client that their dog got hit right in front of the hospital, right? I can't imagine seeing that. I would be devastated if I saw that, right? So you have to put yourself in their shoes sometimes, right? And sometimes you're having a bad day. They're having a bad day. That has nothing to do with you. Now they're in this majorly emotional, intense situation where financials are going to get brought up. And like I said, emotions are already running high. And you just need to remember that they're human too. This is their fur baby. They want what's best. They don't know what's best. So you need to guide them and be honest, I think, you know, with your prognosis and what it's really going to take sometimes to recover from these really big, big expenses. And
if that animal is that critical,
right,
trust your staff to go continuously update the client.
Right.
Stay with that animal.
Yeah.
If there's a chance where, okay, I think the animal's going to be, is okay for the next couple of minutes.
Yeah.
That's when you get your cue and go talk to them.
Yeah.
Just like, hey, I'm in back with, right, you know, Poncho.
Right.
And I'm trying to stabilize. I'm just trying to give you a heads up. My staff's going to be coming up and talking to you as well. We're going to keep you updated. Just anything you can do to settle them, because exactly, they just got nailed with something
Everything.
That no one wants to ever see.
And I think we forget, too, not everybody has medical training, right? So sometimes you go up and you use your big fancy words and you're trying to describe all these things and these owners look at you with a very, very
act
blank
like
face.
You're trying to talk to your mom,
right,
or your dad or your sister or your brother or your best friend.
Yeah, so having these real conversations with them and, you know, oh my gosh, your pet has hemoabdomen and now, well,
they don't know that's blood.
They don't
in the
understand
belly.
Anything, right? Hey, right now there's a shit ton of blood. I mean, obviously, yeah. I say, but hey, right now there's a ton of blood in the abdomen, right? We got to go into surgery. We got to get it out. We got to figure out where that bleeding's coming from. I don't know whether it's going to be good or bad. I don't want to risk taking X-rays and you know, hematocrit's low. Let's get a blood transfusion and get in and go right now. Like, let's just go. And we've had, where you go in, you get the splenic mass out, and you look, and the liver's covered in tumors, right? And that's awful news when the owners have been sitting there waiting, right, thinking that you're in there fixing everything, and then you come out with horrible news, right? So, I mean, it obviously doesn't always end well, but, I mean, feel like owners just need to feel that you care. Because you do care, right? And that's why you get into vet med, is because you love medicine and you love animals. So, like, you need to show that and be human with some of these clients. Like, it's tough. We get it. We've all, especially being in veterinary medicine, you end up with animals of your own. Most of the time they're lemons. It's the way it goes, right? You always end up with medical nightmares if you work in vet med. And what would you do if that was your pet? You know, how would you treat it? How would you want to be talked to?
Yeah, that's huge. And I learned that early on, but it took time to understand. Like,
yeah,
you got to put yourself in that situation that, like I said, that animal in front of you is considered almost your animal.
Yeah.
And then if that's the case, how would you want your family talked to?
Right. Right.
Right. If you fake your emotions, it actually takes more energy.
Yeah.
It's research. It's proven.
And people see it. I mean, I still remember the first dog I ever saw be euthanized, right? 20 years later. And it wasn't even it was a very peaceful euthanasia. I mean, nothing went wrong. And you have those moments, you know, the pregnant lady when we euthanized. We had another one when we euthanized their dogs. And I remember when these dogs came in as puppies and the kids were little. And when we euthanized, the kids were flying home from college. And you're like, oh my, like, I can't even,
but,
right?
But, you know,
I mean, we're like, your God, you've watched these kids grow up, this dog, it's such a vital part of their family, right? Like,
I was on the third generation of clients.
Yeah.
From the same family.
It's crazy.
When I retired. But you also saw the toll that euthanasia took on me the last few months I was there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you were going out, you were sick.
I was throwing
up
outside.
You were nauseous. You wanted nothing to do with it. And I think what's really hard is, even though you had the staff that was able to do it, you had such a great relationship with all these clients, they didn't want us to do it.
Right.
Even though they knew us and even though they liked us.
I finally had to start being honest with the clients and like, listen, I will be in the room, but I can't actually do this. I'm going to be there sitting with you and supporting you.
Yeah.
But I think what's best for your animal is, you know, for them to do it, because I don't know if I emotionally can handle it.
Right.
And right. I was just being honest.
Yeah.
You know, and I put my heart and I put my emotions right there for everyone to see.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely normal to be a human.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and it hits you in waves too, right? I think you kind of not become, I don't want to ever say you're immune to it, because you're not. But it's something you just kind of learn to take with the profession. And then I had lost one of my dogs who was like my spirit dog. I couldn't go into euthanasia for a while after, right? Because it brings up your feelings and your triggers. But then I'm like, well, how fair is that to these clients who know me, trust me, their dog knows me, we have relationships with all of them. Like, it's more of a benefit for me to be in there than being triggered by it, right? Like, you can do good.
Correct.
With using your emotions, you know, and supporting them. And, you know, maybe GP isn't necessarily for everybody, and that's not a bad thing. You know, there's so many, I think that's one of the great things about vet med. There's so many ways you can go and so many different ways that you can branch out and help people with animals, that if you do get into vet med and you burn out and you're just like, oh my gosh, this isn't what I was expecting. Like, the world is your oyster. I mean, the sky is your limit. You know, it's.
If I was to give you a magic wand.
Okay.
And say you could change one, two, or three things right now about veterinary medicine, what would you change?
I would like to see the pendulum swing back to private ownership. I would like to see the cost of care go down. And I want to see veterinarians getting back in the game. I want to see that passion and that drive back in everybody. I want to see vets who are happy to work there, vets who want to work up cases. They're not just there collecting a paycheck, right? Like, I feel like we've kind of lost that, like, heartbeat and pulse of the profession, right? And I want to see it back. I want everybody to love it as much as I've loved it and enjoy it as much as I've enjoyed it and just feel good about what they're doing at the end of the day, you know, and know that they're making a difference and know that you're helping these animals out. And just, I mean, we did a lot of rescue work. We did shelter work. I mean, but you can do so much good in your position. You know, I want the passion back. I want the love back from these.
So I'm going to give you the floor for the final Mallory words of wisdom. What would you say to people who are struggling out there?
In vet med?
Mm-hmm.
It's par for the course, right? Everybody struggles. Everybody has their ups and downs. You always instilled in us, it's practicing medicine. You're never gonna have it perfected ever. And as soon as you think you have it perfected, you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot, right? Be confident. You have the education. Now get the training going. Now start getting your clinical hours in. Get a good mentor. Go somewhere where you feel supported and loved. Go somewhere where you know you can yell across the hospital and you have a doctor that will come running to help you. If you aren't fitting in with the vibe of your tribe and you don't feel like your clinic is home, there is a clinic out there for you. Not every clinic is for every person, right? So use what you know. Learn your soft skills. Rely on your staff. Techs, I don't know that all techs love it, but I loved being leaned on by doctors and newer students who are coming in. What are your guys' protocols? How do you treat this? Dr. G's not here. What does he normally do? And I'm like, you know, but kind of like just everybody works better together. So trust your staff, find your home, and just thrive and get that passion going back into what you work so hard for.
Well, Mallory, I can't tell you how happy I am that we're back together.
I know.
And it means the world to me. It also means the world that you're part of this podcast.
Yeah.
And you're also going to be part of our new podcast called
Yes.
Irreplaceable Tales, which is going to be geared towards pet owners.
Yes.
We're going to have fun with that one, too.
We are. We may be doing a little Vet Tech Nerd Party spinoff as well.
So, I mean, we have some fun things planned here. And very excited to get them going.
Yeah.
If you do have any questions for Mallory, you can find her email on the website for Orange County Veterinary Assistance School.
Yep.
Or it's Mallory@PacificLensStudios.com.
Yes.
And going forward, if you out there have any ideas of what you want to hear, please let us know immediately.
Yeah.
We would love to get guests in here to talk about it. We're counting on you to make this podcast better. I think we're 31 episodes in.
Yeah. What's your passion? What drives you? What do you think veterinary medicine is lacking? What's your message that you want to get out there?
Even if you want to be on the show.
Yeah.
If you got a message you want to get out there. Yeah. we can Skype you in. We'll be more than happy to have you as a guest.
Yeah.
So thank you again.
Well, thank you, Dr. G. I will officially call you Dr. G.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think use doctor in front of your name very much. I think I've just always referred to you as G.
Exactly.
Even to the clients.
As in G Wiz.
Yeah. But, you know, thank you for 20 years of mentorship and keeping my love in veterinary medicine alive and showing me the ropes and, you know, keeping me on board even after I blew up your ultrasound machine and dyed your dog magenta. He loved it.
Oh, my gosh. I forgot about that. Okay, everyone, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.